We have two cases set for oral argument this morning. One is in front of the panel that you see here today, Justice Triana, Justice Smith, and myself. I'm Judge Byrne. And one in front of a panel anchored by Justice Goodwin, along with Justice Baker from your neck of the woods, and Justice Kelly. As you know, these matters are being recorded, and the audio recording will be available later this afternoon on the court's website. At this point, I'd like to call for ready announcements for the attorney we have here this morning in the first case, which case is CV 0320613, Thibodeau versus Stars Investment Holdings, Inc., and I hope I pronounced that correctly. And it's also known as, doing business as, Georgetown Collision Center. As Stars Investment Holdings waived oral argument prior to today, we will only be hearing from the attorney, and I think I'm supposed to be turning on a microphone, this one here, I think. Is that correct? Yes. There we go. Thank you. Thank you for the reminder. Stars Holding has waived oral argument prior to today and will only be hearing from the attorney, counsel for the Thibodeaus, the appellants. We will rely on the briefing by Stars for their portion of the argument. Mr. Morris, would you please introduce yourself to the court and announce ready, sir? Thank you. Thank you very much. And you may be seated. All right. Thank you. Yes, sir. We have for the third court, just so you know, each side typically has 20 minutes aside. And typically, the appellant will identify how many minutes of their 20 minutes that they would like to do an opening. Then we would go to the appellee. They would do their 20 minutes. And the appellant would typically reserve some time for rebuttal, usually around 5 minutes. But as you can see, we only have the appellant today, so they will certainly do their argument just 20 minutes, and then we will conclude this first case. Now, in front of Justice Goodwin and her panel, you will have both sides, so you're going to see that split in the presentation. We also have a very sophisticated time warning system to assist Mr. Morris today in knowing when his time is up. If you were in Austin, it would be a lighted system, a yellow light and a red light. But today you have the privilege of, we have our Mr. Jeff Kyle, our clerk of the court, will do this incredibly sophisticated, technologically advanced warning system by using the yellow card to identify 2 minutes left in the argument, and then the red will be assigned to Mr. Morris to stop his argument. Now, if he's in mid-thought or mid-presentation, we certainly will give him the courtesy of rapidly concluding and wrapping up his thoughts. And sometimes the court, in its own discretion, may allow Mr. Morris additional time if we have some questions of Mr. Morris. And with that, Mr. Morris, we look forward to hearing from you on behalf of the Thibodeaus, sir. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This case is about upholding the protection provided by the Texas Citizens Participation Act for consumer opinions and commentary against speech chilling lawsuits. And it's also about furthering First Amendment protections set out by United States Supreme Court precedent against libel claims that lack evidence of actual injury or actual malice. In this case, Georgetown Collision Center, who I might refer to as GCC throughout the argument, sued Jack and Carly Thibodeau after they went online and posted genuine, good faith commentary and opinions based on their bad experience with Georgetown Collision fixing Jack's truck, But not only that, Georgetown Collision also sued Jack and Carly based on the negative comments other people posted, responding to Georgetown Collision's own Facebook post attacking Jack Thibodeau simply because he exercised his right of free speech by posting an honest review about his negative experience. It was error for the trial court not to grant the Thibodeaus motions to dismiss under the TCPA, and we're asking this court to reverse and remand. This morning, I have three key points I intend to focus on in terms of why the court should reverse. The first is that GCC failed to meet its TCPA burden on damages. For starters, it admitted in the trial court it could not meet that burden as to its business disparagement claim. That is an easy path for reversal for this court on that claim. Second, the court should reject GCC's claim that it's entitled to presumed damages. The First Amendment bars that without clear and specific evidence of actual malice, which GCC did not provide.
Let me ask you about that on the actual malice. If I got the timeline correct, your client Jack made a post on May 15. That was before Jack had received any invoice from GCC telling him what they had done to his car. That was also prior to the time that he had had any outside analysts look at the car to say that GCC had done anything. So how could you say that it's not malice for Jack to post something when he has no knowledge of the work that GCC even claims they did, nor any expert assessment saying that they did anything wrong or right?
Sure, Your Honor. So let's start first with the test for actual malice. As we all know, it's knowing falsity or reckless disregard for the truth, what the United States Supreme Court has defined as serious doubts about the truth of your statements. Jack observed his car, and if you recall on his Facebook post, he posted pictures of the damage to his truck when he picked it up from GCC. He has his own observations that GCC did not controvert about calling GCC constantly, not getting communications from them, GCC moving the goalposts. As to his statements about what GCC did not replace, recall, yes, he did not take it to the third party, the two independent third party evaluators until after he made his post, but he and Carly did take it to the Don Hewlett Collision Center after he picked it up before he made his post, where he was told that it looks like Georgetown Collision did not replace as much as they were paid to do. That, if you're
now, how would they know what they were paid to do when they didn't have an invoice from GCC yet? Well, how would Don Hewlett know that, and how would Jack know that?
Don Hewlett, if you're Jack Thibodeau, and you're Carly Thibodeau, you're a layperson. You're taking it to a certified collision center, and they're telling you, based on our evaluation, it does not look as if GCC replaced what they did. I think for the actual malice standard, serious doubt about the truth, that's more than enough to get over that hurdle. And remember, it was GCC's burden to show that. Again, when you look at the charts showing substantial truth, we have Jack and Carly's own observations, many of which GCC did not controvert. We have Jack and Carly relying on a certified collision center telling them before their post, it looks like Georgetown Collision did not replace what they were supposed to do. For actual malice, the high standard, that's enough to get over that burden, and that's enough to show why GCC didn't meet their standard, especially, Your Honor, because look at the evidence GCC put on of actual malice. There's none. Their pleadings are conclusory. They simply say Jack and Carly Thibodeau acted with actual malice, or in the alternative, they acted with negligence. The evidence they try to put in, for example, the invoices you talk about, even assuming that Jack and Carly would have seen those, they don't show that would have shown them, they would have known that GCC replaced what it said it did. All it shows is GCC ordered the parts. It doesn't show that they actually put them on Jack's truck. That's a nuance, but it's an important one. Again, given the high bar for actual malice. Now, clearly, there's no evidence that Jack or Carly knew what they said was false. That's a very high mental state. So we have to focus on that reckless disregard for the truth, which again, the Supreme Court defined as serious doubt about the truth of what she said.
Mr. Morris, can we go back to damages? I believe you were talking about that they have failed. You believe that GCC has failed in proving any damages whatsoever. I understand that they're claiming that it's per se, and so they don't need to. But what about the injunctive relief that they're asking for? How does that factor into the damages question? If you're asking for injunctive relief, then, you know, isn't at least that claim, there are no, you know, you don't, there's no damages that you have to prove, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. But the injunctive relief, I think, one, they haven't really briefed that on appeal. I think their sole argument on appeal has been per se damages. Didn't raise that in the trial court as well. Now, I will admit before the court, we didn't move to dismiss that injunctive relief, but if you can't show per se damages, an essential element, how can you then show a likelihood of success on the merits? This is what the Supreme Court got at Gertz and later modified a little bit in Greenmoss, in which the Dallas court correctly recognized in McFarland. If you are going to claim libel per se, and you are going to claim presumed damages, you have to show actual malice when it's speech on a matter of public concern. So that actual malice becomes an essential element. If you can't prove an essential element, how can you then show a likelihood of success on the merits, which we all know is that first prong in the injunctive analysis. I hope that answers your question, Justice Triana.
It does. Talking about McFarland, how do you reconcile that with Lipsky?
So the McFarland case drew a couple distinctions, and I will acknowledge before the court, I think that's the one area McFarland got a little bit wrong, because it says that Lipsky is distinguishable because it didn't talk about public versus private speech. That's not really right, because it's a TCPA case, and of course it's going to be doing the public versus private analysis. It also said that Lipsky focused on special damages, which I think is an important distinction. I think the most important distinction for Lipsky and why it doesn't preclude this court's application of McFarland and really this court's application of the Supreme Court's precedent in Gertz and Greenmoss, Lipsky didn't focus on actual malice. It just was silent on it. So I think what Lipsky does is it just creates a little bit of a gap. And there is a gap in the jurisprudence, I think, between Lipsky and Gertz, because we have Hancock v. Varium, the Texas Supreme Court, saying and analyzing Gertz and Greenmoss, saying that juries can presume general damages in libel cases only if the plaintiff proves actual malice or proves that the speech wasn't public. So we have the Texas Supreme Court acknowledging that to prove presumed damages, to get presumed damages, you have to show actual malice or speech was not public. So we carry over to Lipsky. Lipsky's silent on actual malice. And while it does say that you can presume damages for per se, it only does so in the context of evidence of actual injury. And I think what the important distinction is if you look at the Brady v. Klintzman case that I think GCC cited in their brief, that came a couple years after Lipsky. And they say Lipsky settles the question as to whether once you get presumed nominal damages, you don't have to put on evidence of actual injury. But what it doesn't answer is the question that has to become first. How do you get to presumed damages at all? Gertz tells us and Greenmoss tells us from the United States Supreme Court, you only get to presumed damages once you show actual malice and that the speech was not on a matter of public concern. So once you show that, then of course you don't have to put on evidence of actual injury. That's what Lipsky and that's what the Brady cases from the Texas Supreme Courts are saying. But where McFarland got it right is recognizing that Gertz and Greenmoss, United States Supreme Court's decisions that are binding because it's a First Amendment issue and the Supremacy Clause says so, tells us that because of those First Amendment interests, even with a private figure libel plaintiff who doesn't have to prove actual malice for liability, if they want anything beyond the actual injury they can prove, they have to show actual malice. In a TCPA case, that's all, because it's always going to be on a matter of public concern. So I think the rule that we're asking the court to adopt today, consistent with McFarland and also consistent with the Dallas Courts of Appeals recent decision in the QBE matter, is that a TCPA plaintiff who is asserting a libel per se claim based on First Amendment considerations can only escape TCPA dismissal on a theory of presumed damages if they show actual malice.
And when you say show actual malice, when I read a lot of your brief, a lot of your showing truth and showing actual malice, I read it as though you are asserting a preponderance of the evidence is our burden. When at least, well, preponderance of the evidence is your burden on truth, but on actual malice, the burden for GCC is simply prima facie. Pretty small, tiny, tiny amount of proof. And isn't simply the timeline of your client's posting enough, and Carly's posting of, please, everybody pile on. Everybody also make complaints against GCC, whether or not you've ever taken your car to them or not. I mean, isn't that goading the community of Facebook and social media? Come on, pile on. Tell the world how bad GCC is. Does that not get to a prima facie level? Maybe not preponderance. We're not at trial. But prima facie for a motion to dismiss.
No, Chief Justice Byrne, it does not. And let me address Carly's post first. If you look at Carly's post, it comes after GCC went on Facebook and attacked Jack. And she's saying spread the word. She's responding to people's posts that are saying, hey, we went online and we shared about what GCC posted about Jack. So at best, there's ambiguity in what she's talking about spreading the word. And as Lipsky tells us, clear and specific evidence means free from ambiguity, certain. So that evidence cannot show actual malice. And again, I know while ill will can sometimes be circumstantial evidence of actual malice, it has to accompany some other evidence showing a knowing publication with knowing falsity or serious doubt. I want to draw the court's attention to a recent decision from this court. That's the Troe v. Johnson case. And I think Justice Smith was on that panel. There you had a consumer leave a review about a skydiving business where he said things such as they don't maintain their planes, the owner is a drunk. They hire inexperienced instructors and instructors with no experience. They don't follow the rules of the sport. But he didn't provide in his review any of the factual basis for that. So that's sort of like that Bentley v. Button case that GCC relies on, where you have a talk show host spouting off all these factual assertions, but he's not giving any indication that he had a reason to believe their truth. He's not giving any indication that he did any investigation at all. That's opposite of what Jack did here. Again, Jack didn't just post, GCC is awful, their owner's a druggie, they ruin people's cars. He gave a detailed account of everything that he based his ultimate opinion on, which was GCC did more damage to my truck than when I took it in there, and I don't take your car here. A detailed account. And he talked about how he took his truck to Don Hewitt. And again, whether or not that is substantially true, that's not the question on actual malice. What the Don Hewitt review did is gave Jack a reason to believe the truth. So it refuted that second prong of actual malice, which is that serious doubt. So when you compare, I think, the Troe v. Johnson decision in the Yelp and Facebook post in that case with Jack's post, it becomes clear that Jack had a basis and he was telling the readers, he's explaining, here is why I think what I'm saying is true. When you have that sort of detailed account and you have a lack of evidence from GCC controverting so much of that, they do not argue that there was glass shards blowing out of the vents. They don't challenge that the interior was torn up, the radio was broken, the paint was scratched. They don't challenge that they, both Jack and Carly said, that they exchange waiving deductibles for people not leaving negative reviews. So you have, again, I just want to sum it up, Jack giving all the factual basis for his opinion, his ultimate opinion, and very little evidence, if any, controverting that. That cannot meet the standard of actual malice, even under a prima facie standard. So I just want to sum up again on the damages issue. Because of the Supreme Court's decision in Gertz and Green Moss, the First Amendment bars GCC here from relying on presumed damages. And I don't think there's any dispute that they did not show clear and specific evidence of actual injury. So the lack of damages here is what mandates TCPA dismissal, and that's one reason the court should reverse. I want to move on, Your Honors, this morning, because I think we're running out of time, to the conspiracy and the second, the aiding and abetting claims, which I think is the other very interesting issue on this appeal. You have GCC saying that Jack and Carly are liable for almost all these negative comments that others went online and posted. First, as we've briefed, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act forbids them from that theory of liability. Understood. There is not a lot of case law dealing with
that. But they're not a provider. They're not like Facebook or Twitter. And doesn't it require, doesn't that statute protect Facebook and Twitter, not Jack and Carly who use Facebook to post?
It protects Twitter and Facebook, which are the information content providers. But the plain text, which we urge this court to follow here, the plain text states, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any other information provided by another information content provider. So it's that or user part where Jack and Carly fall in. There's no dispute, they're a user of Facebook. There's no dispute Georgetown Collision Center is trying to hold them liable for what other people posted on Facebook. So by the plain text of Section 230, they fall within that. And I acknowledge, Your Honor, the case law out there focuses almost exclusively on the Twitters, the Facebooks, people hosting blog comments. But I think there's an interesting way to look at this that actually shows why the Thibodeaux, at least Jack, even fall within that category. When Jack posted his comment, he's essentially opening up his Facebook post to comments by others. So in the way I understand Facebook works is he has the ability to delete comments from that thread or not. So he is, in turn, acting like an information content provider by providing his post. So 230 would, even under the theory you just espoused, Chief Justice, would immunize him from posts that others made on his comment thread for his post criticizing GCC.
But he's not being sued for others' post. He's being sued for aiding and abetting, assuming that there's that is an actual claim, and he's being sued for conspiracy. So let's assume, for argument's sake, that 47 U.S.C. 230 does apply. How is it that we're applying it to him when I see it the reverse? It's like other people are using his words as opposed to he's not reposting what somebody else said about GCC.
I think, Justice Triana, if the situation had been that others were merely sharing Jack's post, then I think 230 would not apply. But here they're not just using his words. They're going, the posts that GCC are complaining about from other users are independent created content. Yes, they're talking about Jack, but they're not just sharing his post. They're creating other things about GCC. They're materially contributing to that.
But so, isn't 230, the basis for it is to prevent me, even if it's a user, from being liable for reposting somebody else's content?
That's one basis of 230. But it's also, if you think of the purpose of 230, which is to promote free expression on the internet, it's also to protect people who post things and then have others go and transform them from liability as well. Your Honors, I see my time is up. May I just briefly conclude?
Yes, and if it's okay, I have one more question after this.
Absolutely,
sure.
Judge.
And so I think if you think about the policy, consider what would happen if it was the opposite. If you could be liable for simply commiserating online over a shared complaint or a shared gripe, it would open up a whole range of internet speakers to lawsuits, and that would chill political speech, speech about consumer welfare, speech about community issues, and that would defeat the purpose of Section 230.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. My last question is, do you know of any recent authority that refutes the principle in Tilton versus Marshall that I think this court in Warner Brothers Entertainment versus Jones espoused, that we don't analyze separately the court's refusal to dismiss under TCPA participatory liability claims if we conclude that they did not err by refusing to dismiss the defamation claim?
So I would point the court, one, to the Court of Appeals decision that preceded the Supreme Court's decision in Ray Lipsky. That was the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, and we've cited it in our brief. They looked at the conspiracy claim as a separate cause of action, said the plaintiff did not put on clear and specific evidence of an agreement, and so they dismissed that conspiracy claim separately under the TCPA. Second, I think this court's decisions, in Craig v. Tejas Promotions and the neurodiagnostics cases that we cite in our brief, both looked at the elements of conspiracy and applied them to the TCPA burden shifting. And I would also add this, that's my last point, Justice Triana, this is different because you're not having, the derivative claim here is not based on the Thibodeau's posts, it's based on the posts of others. So when we look at the Supreme Court's recent decision in Agar, the Supreme Court tells us that in Texas, conspiracy damages is focused on the underlying tort. So here, the Thibodeaus, even to get close to proving conspiracy, they would have to make a prima facie showing for the underlying tort, which is every one of those comments they claim that the Thibodeaus agreed to in defaming and disparaging them. That evidence isn't there. And at the end of the day, there's no clear and specific evidence that the Thibodeaus agreed with anybody, even circumstantially, to defame or disparage GCC. I want to thank the court for their time this morning. My clients, you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Morris, and thank you, everyone. This court stands in recess, and we appreciate the good argument, Mr. Morris. Thank you. The court will stand in recess.